morning. My name is Peter Rehberg. I'm the chair of this panel. I am a queer writer and researcher based in Berlin and also head of the archive and collections at Schwules Museum here in Berlin and on the steering committee for this arms conference. And very happy to chair this panel, drawing on fantastic memories. As opposed to four speakers this morning, we unfortunately only have two presenters, two dropped out and couldn't come to Berlin, which gives us a little bit more time both for discussions and also for the presentations itself. So this panel looks at mediated and artistic practices then that perhaps can negotiate the limits of the archive as a dispositive of power and knowledge. One example, as the title already gives away, would be, for example, drawing. So in my understanding from what I've read here in terms of the proposals, this is a question about how the archive can not just be a place of being, but also a place of becoming. And those questions, how aesthetic practices intervene, intertwine with other archival practices, is of course also for me, in the position of the archivist at Schwules Museum, a very exciting question. Some of the questions will also concern, I think, the question of temporality, how the archive is not just a question of the past, but has potentials for alternative queer futures. I think these are some of the issues we will be addressing in the two talks we have, and I'm very happy to announce as our first speaker, Juana Maria Rodriguez. She's a professor of ethnic studies, performance studies, and gender and women's studies at the University of California at Berkeley. And she talks about drawing this morning, and the ways in which drawing functions as an alternative form of apprehending sexual memories and experiences. And the title of her talk is Capturing Memories, Sexual Archives, and Queer Documentation Practices. So please give a warm welcome to Juana.
Thank you so much for joining us on this warm Saturday morning. So my talk today is kind of a meditation more than an argument about the kinds of archival practices we might use to record the moods, traces, and feelings that sexual adventures leave behind. Before I became an academic, I was an amateur artist, drawing and coloring in the private spaces of the many journals I kept as a teenager. So my presentation today looks back on some of those early documentation practices as a way to make material my own sexual archive of feeling. An archive of feeling is, of course, Anne Svetkovich's term. So I want to thank you in advance for indulging me in what is unequivocally a self-indulgent meandering between art and sex of my own queer past. Let me begin by saying that I was a teenage slut, a spick slut, to be precise, a puta. By 17, I had already amassed a double-digit list of lovers, both male and female, mostly one-night stands, orgies with friends, a string of anonymous lovers that I picked up and fucked in random places. I always took a special joy fucking in public places, a men's bathroom in the New York City subway station, against the walls of St. Patrick's Cathedral, on the roof, that was a good one, on the rooftop of the Civic Center, and in assorted, secluded, and semi-public urban alleys. It was a time before AIDS, before queer, before my initiation to anything that might be called feminism, and sex was a particularly delightful way to express freedom, agency, and teenage rebellion. In high school, I discovered queer bars and lesbian bookstores, both wonderful places to pick up new sexual adventures and the occasional book. So this is where art comes in. In that lesbian bookstore, I found The Cunt Coloring Book by T. Corinne. It was filled with line drawings of differently shaped cunts, And I appreciate, I mean, I admit I appreciate a warm dick as much as the next bi chick, but I love pussy. By the time I was a senior in high school, I had already found a butch, 12 years my senior, a seasoned top who moved me into her apartment and wanted me all to herself. Dawn was a thoughtful and creative sexual mentor, and in those days before Good Vibrations went online and crafty entrepreneurs started making sex toys, soft, fleshy bodies might actually want to use, we would make our way to the local adult sex shop in my hometown of Hartford, Connecticut, to buy porn, poppers, hard plastic dildos, and whatever sexual paraphernalia caught our eye. When I talk to my students about what it means to actually have to go to a store with the big X's outside, right? So like sex before the internet, sex toys before the internet. Dawn and I played all the usual youthful games, exploring food, bondage, hot wax, and the size of our fists, all the while snapping dirty Polaroids to document our sexcapades. So I don't have any of those, sadly. In her wisdom, she worried that my youth and slutty ways might make anything resembling lesbian monogamy difficult. So we frequently picked up women together and brought them home. As part of our ritual for these three-way trysts, in the morning, over awkward coffee, Dawn and I would bring out a box of Crayola crayons and invite our evening guests to leave their mark in our cunt coloring book. So, of course. Like so many other coloring books, T. Corinne's book was a pedagogical project, originally published in 1975 by Pearl Child Productions in San Francisco, a city I would later call my own. It proudly announced itself as a woman-made book. The first two pages offer a diagram of all the relevant parts and a feminist homage to the cunt. It reads, "In the beginning, we come from the cunt, not from some man's side, and we are washed in the water and blood of birth, not the spear-pierced side of some dying god. In the beginning, women made pots and jars shaped like wombs and breasts and decorated them with triangles which were symbols of the cunt. So the first art was cunt art. There are tribal women today who sing praises of their cunts, how pretty and long and full their lips are, how the hair curls and glistens with moisture. The drawings in this book are real women's cunts." And so I should remind my audience that this was like 1970s, and women-born women took their cunts very seriously. And they took their imagined exoticized connection to tribal women's cunts even more seriously. We can, of course, critique and undo the touchy-feely 1970s "we are our wombs" feminist essentialism of their rhetoric, but really, why bother? It sort of undoes itself. We won't be bad to the 70s, yes. Back then, I was mostly a baby bar dyke and had not actually met too many lesbian feminists. Their language sounded as foreign to me then as it does now. I just liked the pictures, and I loved to color. While most of those images were colored during those early years of the late 70s, I kept this book and kept inviting different lovers to color it up until 1991, when the blank pages ran out. So in the morning, over café con leche, we would offer our overnight guests. We would sit at the kitchen table and color. There were the shy ones, who, faced with our rather unusual request, might have been a bit hesitant about our invitation to color, or by the vibrant expression of female anatomy that the book offered. rather than visual verisimilitude, choosing colors to draw on the corporeal forms presented required a kind of visual imagination. Choosing colors to draw in the corporeal forms presented, using color to capture mood and personal proclivities. They also often required quite a bit of coaxing to get our guests to participate. Honestly, my own signature fills the majority of the pages, but it was a fun exercise in extending sexual energies and intimacies onto an external surface, capturing the mood of the night's reverie in vivid hues. Because, as the opening text affirmed, these are real women's cunts. Some of our guests would flip through the pages looking for one that might match their own genitalia. Or perhaps they were looking for a visual match for my own pussy. But the feminist message that every sexual organ is different and unique, each sex a snowflake, made that effort pointless. There's something particularly delightful about coloring books. They are so often associated with the carefree time of analog childhoods before the kitty crack known as iPads. Coloring in Tikarin's simple drawings was a moment to get lost in the seductive folds of multi-shaped vulvas, to contemplate the quirky ways that a clitoris can play hide and seek, to revel in the perfect tight roundness of a puckered asshole, to translate the sensory pleasures of sexual memory into visual form. In retrospect, only a few of these early three-way encounters have survived in my memory. Mostly, they blur together. I remember Wendy, the coke dealer slash car dealer, Debbie, the sex worker who was the ex of my ex, who she called Daddy, and I think Michelle might have been the bisexual co-worker who we fucked and exchanged Polaroids with, but honestly, I'm not too sure. Coloring seemed a silly and decidedly childish way to keep track of our sexual adventures, but that too formed part of the charm. It was not public sex in the sense of the street or the bar, but it externalized a trace of the erotic onto paper, into a book that could be held and perused. Coloring was also a non-threatening way to express my own artistic proclivities. The expectations were low, and I could lose myself tracing my crayons inside and outside the lines that T. Corinne had left behind. Years later, I began to leave the childish pleasures of coloring within the lines and shift more of my creative visual musings into my journal. There, I would venture my own drawings. This one, clearly inspired by T. Corinne's, I titled El Lunar de Ana, Ana's birthmark, although Lunar sounds so much more sensuous. But most of the drawings that are collected in my journal were self-portraits, the selfies of another era, like this one with my mid-80s haircut, or these pensive pastels. I am never quite sure if they actually look like me, or perhaps they look like the me that I was trying to find. Sometimes they were marked with text, like this one, Pensando en Cuba, a birthday portrait of me at 27, or this one, Mujer y Árbol en Otra Selva de Aguas Dulces, Regalo de Ochum, Woman and Tree in Another Jungle of Sweet Waters, a gift from Ochum. I started signing these with my given name, Juana María de la Caridad, a reference to La Caridad del Cobre, the patron saint of Cuba, who is syncretized reference to Ochum. Ochun is the river goddess of Yoruba tradition and the Santeria practices I grew up in. In my drawings, she makes occasional appearances. Perhaps these are my own attempts to connect with an imagined past on a lush and verdant island of which I have sketched memory. In some of these drawings, I reference another lover, Connie Lopez Jackson, my black butch partner who I kept loving and leaving for the better part of the 1980s. This one references the lyrics of a Rubén Blades song, Las cuentas del alma no se acaban nunca de pagar. You never finish paying the soul's debts. Eventually, I moved first to San Francisco and then to New York and back again to the Bay Area. And other lovers and sexual adventures made their way into the pages of my journal. This is Julia Sumi La Chica, a fly Japanese Filipina femi-butch, a native San Franciscan from the projects in Chinatown, who was my fuck buddy and guide into this new city. She also appeared with me on the pages of On Our Backs, a photo shoot taken on a rooftop, the city lights sparkling in the background. She's still my best friend. But drawing others has always seemed more difficult, a task best left to those more talented than myself. Many of the drawings in my journals are nothing more than a 3-minute sketch, a visual capture of a mood or a feeling or a memory, an image to capture my day when writing seemed redundant. There are images that come from somewhere outside of the world that I inhabit, from somewhere I might call spirit. These are more open and direct, even as they feel more measured and precise. Only a few are overtly sexual, a way to use my pen to capture fantasies or memories or the spaces where they collide. In 1990, I moved to New York City to attend graduate school at Columbia and lived without television or internet. As an anxious graduate student, I would read a book a day, Monday through Friday, and I would spend my weekends reveling in the Boricua butches and queer Latin nightlife that the city offered. My sister gave me a set of watercolors, and that year I painted quite a bit. If in some I appear in my usual high femme Latina drag, here I am on my way to La Escolita, a dive Latin bar in New York City, which has since closed. In others, stripped of my hoop earrings, I appear downright androgynous. This nude in blue reads Una Cubana Más en Nueva York, just another Cuban in New York. While most are similar in style, line, and color, there are others that seem to capture something else. The angry, raging, crazy ones that captured a moment that has passed. Here are two sides of the journal page with the number of my bank teller card, right, early days of ATMs, scribbled in the margins. I don't draw anymore, not really. I don't journal much. I still dance, I still fuck. But academic life doesn't leave much time for coloring cunts or wallowing in self-portraits. And lately, my academic writing is plenty full of indulgent autobiographical riffs about the multicolored hues of sex. Looking back on old drawings is something akin to looking back at undergraduate papers. They are terrifying to read, but every now and then you see a glimmer of a previous self that still looks just a little familiar. Being an artist is quite like being an academic or a poet. You don't ever believe you're fully capable or worthy of the time and attention of others, and mostly I am not. Yet the joy of the process endures. It inspires the work of making books, making talks, making poems. I have carried these journals, a heavy box full, from city to city for the last 30 years. stored them away in the closets of the many lives I have lived. Even as I opened these dusty boxes, looking for these forgotten images, I couldn't quite bring myself to read the pages and pages of emotional purges that consume the text of those journals, stopping only occasionally as I flip the pages to remember a name, a heartbreak, a place I have since left behind. I have rarely shared these drawings with others, relishing instead the private pleasure of knowing that once, a long time ago, I narrated the lines and colors of my queer sexual life in pictures. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Juana, very much for sharing.
Juani.
Yeah, you got this?
Juani, will you full screen for me?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Juana, for sharing this meditations on your visual sexual autobiography. Our next speaker is Julian Carter. Julian is Associate Professor of Critical Studies at the California College of the Arts. And he is talking about aspects of trans embodiment and temporality. The presentation is looking at strategies for documenting the force of fantasy to change who we are and what we become. The talk of Julian's title is Transing the Archive, Touching Fantasy Across Generations. Well, please welcome Julian.
Well, hi there. Interestingly, you know, I didn't notice this when we were talking earlier, but my talk and Juana's both shuffle back and forth between the 1970s and the 1990s in kind of interesting ways. I'm a dancer, and as such, I communicate with my body. And one thing I know for sure is that bodies don't make arguments. That's just not what we do. So I don't do that here. Instead, this paper will consider some relationships that emerged from an art project I made in 2017 and some of my current thinking that emerged from that project about fantasy and desire as historical forces. So this project began when lesbian curator E.G. Crichton, who presented yesterday, invited me to participate in a really cool archivally based group show that was slated for the GLBT Historical Society Museum in San Francisco. The premise of the show was to mark the 30th anniversary of Outlook, which was the gay and lesbian quarterly published from 1988 to 1992. And the show was intended to offer an opportunity for transgenerational, cross-generational contact between generations of queers, so that E.G. took issues from the archives and matchmade, choosing a person or two people from a range of different disciplines in the arts and humanities to respond to that issue. And the way we were supposed to respond was by making new work that would link past and present. Everything else was up to us. So I made a set of Crack and Peel stickers and a chapbook called Sex Time Machine for Touching the Transcestors. Both of these works on paper document a social choreography piece that is called the Transgenerational Touch Project. Social choreography is a hybrid live art form that combines elements of performance art with social practice and dance. That means that I arrange and direct people in space and time. I use patterned movement and structured play to engage participants' multisensory awareness, the point being to balance cognitive analysis with sensual understanding of a given situation or idea. So both of these photographs are of students of mine, grad students. The ones up here are working out as a classroom some mutual experience that they've been studying about that had to do with current precarity as a form of constraint. And so they were trying, like, how do we live that together was their question. And here on the bottom, I have a different group of students in a different class who were trying to figure out some questions that had to do with the geometry of Solowit's 1970s wall drawings. So this was about how do you arrange people in right angles? How do you draw with the self in that kind of way? Social choreography is an analytic as well as a compositional approach. It can be used to elucidate assemblages of many different kinds. Here on the left, you have a meeting of the American Historical Association. Here on the right, you have the same group of students who were working on constraint had the following week some essays that were based on queer community in the 70s and 80s, which none of them, of course, had experienced. And their understanding of community is so mediated through digitality that they expressed a strong desire to experience the intimate physical support that their primary sources were emphasizing. And so this is one of the ways that they tried to work out what would that look like in a graduate seminar. Social choreography as an analytic can be used to explore a range of different kinds of situations, from group prayer, which is what's happening at the top, to riots, that stone wall at the bottom. The guy on the left, the blonde guy, is John Lauritsen. And the reason I wanted to show these two particular pictures is that they are both actually full of hands. These are about touch. Social choreography can also elucidate the places where group prayer and riots overlap. For instance, in political activism. So here we have, both of these are from San Francisco in 1990, the year that I started being active there. And you'll see, it's actually, I think, quite interesting to think about a die-in as a form of group prayer. But you'll also notice here that this is full of hands. These are another form of engagement resting on touch through the fingers. As a medium, I thought that social choreography lined up well with, e.g., the curator's prompt to revisit the collective energies of queer 1991 and bring them in the present to build a new sense of connection across time. Now, I typically use social choreography to explore intercorporeal connection. But in fact, the Transgenerational Touch Project began with a sense of deep disconnect. This is the essay, the issue that E.G. assigned to me, Winter 1991, Birth of a Queer Nation. When I first opened the envelope in which she sent me a copy of this, I was so excited, right? I remember this essay from bookstores, issue from bookstores at the time, and I knew a lot of different people who were featured in it, and some of them I'm still acquainted with. So I was really carried away with the historical thrill of recognition. But as I read it, I had this odd sensation that the magazine did not, in fact, recognize me, which is what I looked like then. I know that I was there then in all my proto-trans complexity, and I know that I was not culturally alone. I was part of community. But our presence, this way of being in the world, did not register in the issue I had been assigned. And as I flipped through them, I really didn't find much that I recognized in the other issues from this era. In fact, what I saw was that the Queer Journal of Record documents an erotic world that was still organized primarily around sexual difference, even as it had begun to develop cross-gender alliances in its political praxis, right, which is one of the things that you can see in the picture of Queer Nation, that we have men and women engaged in same-sex couples mixed together. But you're not seeing in this picture that aspect of Queer Nation that was about dykes and faggots who became lovers, or who worked so closely together that the difference between being lovers and being family to one another became very difficult to parse. So I had quite a predictable impulse, because I was trained as a historian originally, to correct the omission of this world from the Journal of Record and write trans back into history. This is a project that lots of people pursue. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized that actually being illegible was much more congruent with my actual experience of San Francisco in 1991. This was part of the way that I was trans in that place and time. So instead of trying to correct and complete the archive, I decided to trans it. Transing is about movement, primarily. But it is also about connection. And the particular connection I'm thinking of resides in the word transitivity. If we look at grammar, transitivity is a verb that requires an object to complete its meaning, right? This is something that is true about all forms of transgender, I will assert, that it depends on a kind of relational completion. Trans people become recognizable as who we experience ourselves as being by moving in the world as though we already are what we intend to become. Right? It's quite all right.
There's more seats here in the front.
Come on up. It's fine. So let me do that again. So trans people become recognizable in the world as who we experience ourselves as being by moving in the world as though we already are who we imagine we want to become. The particulars of that movement and our social reception are what define each trans person and our particularity. So, transing necessarily involves complex relations both to temporal sequence and to interpersonal recognition. So, how do you trans an archive? I began to generate choreographic strategies for materializing the historical and relational force of fantasy, the work that imagination and projection do in the real. My fantasy for this project was to evoke the public sexual shamelessness of queer culture in 1991 San Francisco, which was really fun. So for the Transgenerational Touch project, I chose two younger artists, Jordan and Zach, whose work explores issues of trans erotic legibility and bodily persistence. Both of these are people who work with the fact that trans bodies change through aging, through hormones, through surgery, through various combinations of these things. For 3 months, we collaborated in ongoing investigations of trans sexuality as a series of social and historical gestures. So I set up dinners and weekend retreats. I introduced them to queer transcestors. I facilitated visits to hot tubs, art galleries, surgeons, and even a drive-through tree. I gave them bodywork, listened to their stories, and made them paper dolls. Basically, I tried everything I could think of that might help transfer the felt sense of an earlier cultural moment's gender indeterminacy and sexual determination to these much younger bodies. So the social choreography was the art in itself. It's not about the documentation, but I wanted to produce something for AG's show, and it's really hard to condense 3 months of intense social interaction. The project involved about 25 people over the course of those 3 months. I couldn't just like put that in a gallery. So partly for that reason, and partly because all live art relies on documentation to prove that it happened, I wanted to make some stuff. Typically, live arts, including choreography, performance, and social practice, are documented through a combination of media, usually photographs, written scores or instructions for the work, and paper ephemera, in this case, one of my Queer the Nation stickers. But these kinds of things show up in many different archives. I used all of these techniques as ways of proving that the art event actually happened, and I also translated significant portions of the project to drawings. So the reason I was interested in drawing for this project is that unlike photographs or typewritten scores, drawings necessarily display their own mediation. Their existence testifies to the potency of human imagination and its materialization through physical gesture.
Sorry to interrupt, but we get the sign that we have low battery on the computer.
Yeah, that's there odd. Might be enough for the rest of the talk.
Is it good? Yeah, okay.
You sure?
Thanks.
All right. I hope so. I'll hold it against you. When I pick up a pencil, part of what I'm doing is claiming the world-generating force of fantasy. I can make things happen that have never existed otherwise. I literally stroke these bodies into being. When I add my drawings to the archive, I expand its capacity to serve as an index not only to what actually happened, in whatever degree of recency it passed, but also to document the mobile transitivity of dreams, memory, and anticipation, and the relationships that emerge from their layered looping. So I know that sounds kind of abstract, so I'll elaborate with two specific examples from the Transgenerational Touch Project that help to make this a little clearer. Come on. So both of these come from the part of the project that worked intensely with Zach, the pretty boy in the hot tub. And they are called Flirtation Number 2 and Flirtation Number 1, respectively, because I wanted to count down. So Zach got that tattoo in 2017 during the Transgenerational Touch Project. At the time, he was editing Lou Sullivan's diaries for publication. And maybe not everyone knows that Sullivan was the white American who talked medico-psychiatric gatekeepers in the U.S. into revising then-current standards of care to allow medically assisted transition for people who wanted to live queer lives. He is often credited as the first gay trans man. He died of AIDS in 1991, as issue 11 of Outlook and Zach were both gestating. Zach's tattoo design comes from a photograph taken around 1980 when Lou documented his top surgery and left the photograph in his archive. Even before Zach began working with Lou's papers in the GLBTHS, he came across that photograph on outhistory.org, which was a quite early, essentially gay Wikipedia that circulated, and it's still out there on the web, but it hasn't been being updated or added to for some time, and its visual presence is very 2000. So the picture, the image then documents Lou's emergence as a historical icon alongside a later moment in the development of the internet as a community archive. And it also documents Zach's emergence as a trans subject participating in a community based in part on an imagined collective past. When Zach transferred the image to his skin, he rematerialized Lou's healing in his own flesh. The tattoo repeats the carving that it depicts, while it documents Zach's effective and libidinal attachment to his archival subject. This is not just a tattoo. It is a performative transfer of carnal love across transgenerations. Every man who handles Zach's ass also touches Lou. The image literally reinscribes Lou Sullivan into contemporary queer sexual community. And when Zach shared the photograph with me, he looped me into that collective bodily life. I responded by adding my touch to the image. So transferring the image from one medium to another changes what the image means and what it does beyond documentation. As a photograph, it raises the question of whose line of sight it records. This could be a selfie taken with a timer, or maybe somebody got down on their knees and like took this photograph of Zach's ass in a straight line. I didn't ask him. But the ambiguity is interesting to me because what it does is return visual agency to Zach. What you see is his will in pulling up his shorts and showing you this thing. Flirtation number 2, in contrast, my drawing, returns my hand to the image as well as his. I am the one who caressed these details into being, feeling my way into each fold of Zach's short shorts, adding emphasis to the soft mound of his ass and the saucy tilt of his pelvis underneath. And when I was done with that, I took the place of the tattoo artist, inscribing Zach's desire for another man long dead. The companion image, Flirtation Number 1, is of Robert Lawrence. It is based on a photograph from the summer of 1973, when Robert, who was then a trucker, stood in front of his big rig in a small beach town in mid-coastal California, performing his genderfuck desirability for a professional photographer named Vera, which I know because on the back it says, photographs by Vera. The photograph emphasizes the contrast between Robert's plaid and his lace, his contrapposto curve, and the strong vertical lines of the 18-wheeler. Rendered in pencil, it activates the erotic charge of queer gender across time. Drawing Robert's long-ago sultriness into the present reproduces the social life of Robert's memory of his own provocative stance in the world. The resulting image thus testifies to the persistence of fantasy and desire and their mobility across bodies as well as across time, because it transfers the image to me when Robert handed it to me during the Transgenerational Touch Project. And that happened because, although Zach knew Lou Sullivan's diaries almost line by line, he had never met anyone who actually knew Lou Sullivan. He had no idea what he was like to be with. So I hooked him up with some old friends whose circle overlapped with Lou's back in the day. What the drawing captures is one of those moments of cross-generational encounter, which it does not depict, but through which the photograph arrived in my hands. That act of transfer echoes Robert's embodied reenactment of his historical flirtatiousness, making eye contact with Zach as he reminisced about trans men sucking cock at long ago sex parties. The original version of this drawing for the zine is in the same style as, say, the paper dolls or the line drawing of me. It's mostly an outline, but I returned to elaborate the image just last month, actually. And that was for a reason. This version, which requires a certain durational focused engagement over time with an image, it's much slower to do this stuff than the quick line drawings. And part of what that durational engagement with Robert's archived image does is document my own persistent longing for the vibrant erotic subculture in which Robert and I overlapped more than 20 years ago now, and more than 20 years after the photograph was originally taken. What I was doing was considering a fantasy connection between California sexual communities in 1973, 1991, and 2017. I made this image as a kind of prayer that such connections across time can continue, even if we in the US are indeed heading into a political crisis that could become comparable to the AIDS epidemic and its lethal impact on queer and trans bodies. You know what? It's fine, because there aren't any more pictures. The flirtations taken together propose drawing as a technique through which we can materialize fantasies, intimacy with the past. When we draw, we literally inscribe our imaginations on the world. And drawing, like embodiment and fantasy, is simultaneously persistent and ephemeral. Charcoal and graphite leave traces that are always fragile. They're always vulnerable to smudging and to erasure. That's one of the reasons that people use pencil, right? But erasure almost always leaves a discernible mark, and in so doing contributes to the accumulation and layering of our gestures over time. Drawing tells us that it's okay to approximate and summarize and approach the past from many different directions. If youth and the body are ephemeral, fantasy is even more so, to the point of evanescence, and yet it can be remarkably stubborn and persistent and has enormous power to shape the real. We all make the world out of imagination and desire. So against my doctoral training in history, which warned me to hew close to documentary evidence against the risk of misrepresenting the past, I assert a different kind of archival responsibility. I don't think that we contaminate or disrespect the past when we draw on all our senses and all the different forms of intelligence to apprehend the past. On the contrary, we can gain an enhanced sense of its vital integrity. Those people were alive. They experienced their bodies as real, not as two dimensions. Reaching out to touch the sensuous lives of others, I think, manifests deep care for their bodily and psychic well-being, as well as our own. It is an act of respect and relationship. It's a kind of active listening, if you will. We might not get their past quite right, but that very risk of misrepresentation is why we attempt it in the first place. Through it, we can demonstrate to ourselves and to others that we will do the work of being in relation. Thank you.
Can we reconnect it? Maybe we want to come back to some of the pictures in the discussion. Well, let's see. Do we have enough? What can we plug it in? Do we need this?
I don't know if there's.
I think the only other open outlet is in the back, actually.
I'm not sure where this one is.
Can we please?
I just not
both of those. These
ones
are already
well,
here.
Do they have
to
close
it? Yeah, so open it. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll find out, right?
Okay.
If we need to close it again, we can.
I don't know.
And this one has.
Do we get some power?
Yeah. I'm sure we will. Give it a minute.
Yeah, it's coming. It's
Power,
okay, so then that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
We made it.
Did we?
Yes.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Would you like to sit with Zach's ass?
Yes. Let's sit with Zach's ass.
Yeah, thank you both.
Zach.
Do you want to go one further? Yeah. And yes, please take some time. Thank you both for this wonderful presentations, Juana and Julian. Julian's elaborations on how what it means to bring bodies together, how social choreography creates a political space, or how through tattoos we can embody a certain kind of queer historiography, queer temporality. So maybe I just want to start with one, two questions to each of you before we open up the discussion to everybody. We have half an hour to discuss. And maybe I start with you, Julian. And I was wondering if you want to say a little bit more about what it means to have queer solidarity based on physical relationships as opposed to, say, knowledge or morals, right? So this is how if I understood your talk correctly, this is kind of the emphasis of your project, that it really does make a difference if the physicality, the embodiment, mm-hmm. is our point of departure for social and political movement. Mm-hmm. That's a broad question, I know, but maybe you can say a little bit more about this, how you distinguish this from, say, other approaches of political solidarity. I mean, I'm saying this because I feel that queer solidarity, we might say, is also in the times of crisis, right? Or there's a lot of questions how we negotiate identity politics, how we bring different forms of representations, different interests together, how we share a queer space. And in these times, the question of physicality and embodiment seem to be crucial for you.
You can't make solidarity without bringing people together. That's why we have conferences, right? People travel across the world to sit in a room together because it is different than talking on the phone or being digitized. I think the same thing holds. I don't think that that embodied presence is different either from ethics or from politics, right? That we think differently in different media, but the thinking is there either way. And the kind of knowledge that we gain of one another and of our places in the world through lovemaking or through eating together, holding hands, sitting next to a stranger at the lunch table upstairs, these forms of proximity create the relationships without which we cannot have mass movements. Right? For some of this thinking, I'm drawing on You can imagine, and I think about this in different ways, but one source that I use for this stuff is the kind of thinking that Judith Butler does in the
Politics of Assembly book. What's that called again?
Rules of Assembly.
Yeah. Thank you. But some of it also just comes from dance history, that there is a problematic in for all dancers, that the movement that we make in space vanishes as it's made. Mm. So the question arises for everyone who works in this field, how do you repeat a dance? Mm. And the answer is you can't. But we are also able to keep dances alive for centuries. There are people probably in Berlin right now who could teach you how to do a 17th century Flemish folk dance. And the way that we can do that is the transmission of knowledge from body to body.
Yeah.
That's really how you do it.
Just a quick follow-up question, because you know the way that you present it, nothing seems more convincing than this, you know, the way that you present it. And
I'm
still
so happy to hear that.
And still, I'd say we keep forgetting this in a way, right? And that's something, why do we forget this?
In the United States, part of the reason it's called Title IX, part of it is historically the fear of cross-generational sexuality as one of the forms of perversion with which queer people have been charged for centuries, right? To the extent that we actually do have cross-generational relationships, that is one of the reasons for hating us and doing nasty things to us because of that hatred. What do you think, though? Why is it so hard to remember this?
Being in, when you're actually in space together, you have to, well, maybe you have to agree on a language, and that becomes a political act. Maybe you have to agree on the space and how you got there, mm-hmm. and then that becomes a question of access and accessibility. And so I think that when you actually, the process of being in physical relation to one another actually doesn't just happen. It is a series of things. When you're organizing an event or a protest or whatever, it's like, well, what time do you show up? And then people actually show up at the time that they said they would show up. And who's bringing the magic markers? And who's, right? So mm-hmm. it is this kind of, it doesn't sort of just happen.
No.
Mm-hmm. There is all
it's
of this. It's
practice. Always
yeah.
practice.
It's, yeah. Yeah. It is social
choreography,
but practice.
It's always happening.
Yeah.
What I do is highlight it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, sex is always happening, and some people, like Juana, become sex artists. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean, is it happening elsewhere? It just means that some people devote a particular kind of attention and care to helping us all see what is there anyway.
Yeah. I mean, this brings us also to the question of archiving and to your talk. And so I'm curious, when you did those first drawings and then watercolor pictures, did you intend to keep them? And were they part of the journal where you did also the writing was separate from that? Or?
No, they're absolutely part of the journal. I mean, so I would write, and then, you know, sometimes you get tired of writing and you draw. And so what I think is curious is that I don't read those old journals, but I do look at the images. So there's something about reading them that, one, I can't fully read my own handwriting. And maybe I was totally just so upset about some lover that I can't even remember. It's like, whose handwriting? Like, what name is this? So there is a way in which I think the images that are there actually do something different to memory than just mm-hmm. what I wrote. Mm-hmm. In terms of the question of did I intend for them to have a kind of future life, I don't know. I mean, I think there are ways in which the question of, I certainly, as a young person, grew up reading, like, A Nice Nin's Diaries, for example. So the idea that you would write a diary and that someday that would be, like, exist in the world was an idea that I thought of. Of course, now in the digital moment, everything, like, there's just an oversaturation of personal information. Yes, of sharing. So there's almost this kind of living diary that's like your Instagram, your Twitter, and whatever, right? This other kind of feed.
So I think they're just different sort of mediums. Do we expect anyone to be looking at what we tweeted 20 years from now? Well, maybe someone might find that interesting. I don't know. But yeah, so that relationship, I think the medium really does sort of change the kinds of meanings that, that you're able to extract from.
I mean, this relationship between image and text also brings up perhaps a notion that, that you mentioned, namely the one of different forms of archival responsibilities, right? Mm-hmm. Because we might say perhaps something happens in the writing that is detailed knowledge,
yes.
but the picture brings to the fore fantasies or desires or maybe events that didn't happen but you wish they would happen.
Yes, absolutely.
Maybe you want to say a little bit about this, you know, different forms of archival responsibility, both of you.
It's, I'm not quite sure why, but the thing that's coming to mind when you ask that is the next art piece I made after the Transgenerational Touch Project. I haven't told you about this, E.G., but I should. You might really be interested in this. That's the curator who made this whole thing. and artist. I'm sorry. There was a faculty show at my school where we were trying to get first-year undergraduates, I teach at an art college, to understand on a much more tactile, visceral level that their basic humanities requirements are not different from, like, are not fully separable from their basic studio requirements. Because, of course, first-year art students are just like, I don't want to have to read a book. Right? They want to draw all the time. And so we have these faculty shows that are that feature different kinds of making marks on paper to help students see, oh, reading and writing and cognition are not this alien world. And drawings might show up on paper. And I was invited to be in that show, and part of what I did with it was take the notebooks from which I had made the Transgenerational Touch Project and make copies of them. But also just ephemera, like things I wrote on paper towels in the car and a couple of photographs, printed them all out on standard 8.5 by 11 paper, A4, and pleated it, turned them into paper fans, and then stapled the fans all over the gallery walls so that it made this kind of thing that came up and then hung over you. Because what I was trying to get at was something about both immersion and the kind of cheapness, the everydayness of making a paper fan, but just elaborated and elaborated and elaborated and elaborated so that there'd be a sense of like there are a lot of hot days involved in this kind of project. The thing I was trying to get at there is a different kind of archival responsibility than what I was doing in the Transgenerational Touch Project, which actually began with the fact that Zach had never had his ass fisted, because nobody in his age group knows how. I was like, really? Like, that's got to change. So, if to the extent that Foucault was right, and ass fisting is actually the only recently invented sexual practice, it seems quite important to me to pass it down. So Robert was somebody who really knew how to do that. And that was part of why I chose Robert as one of the people to hook him up. And in the end, we have one of those a transgenderational problem that Robert's too old. The day that we had set up for that date, his neuralgia was really acting up, and his hands just did not want to do that. So we had dinner instead. He was sharing these photographs and being like, oh, I was so cute back then. And that was good too. But that the archival responsibility can be one of sexual technique.
Yes.
It can be one of a certain kind of approach to, say, genital anatomy. These things are generationally specific. And passing them down through erotics is actually, I think, very important. And I think that there is a real place for, there is a kind of archival responsibility that abstraction and the removal, moving away from language permits. That if I'm not going to give you all the words, and I'm not even going to give you legible pictures because I've folded them all up into little fans, then you have to engage with the trace of my action in a way that puts a lot of responsibility on you as a viewer to figure out what's happening here and how you feel about it. And that, I think, is a different kind of archival responsibility, one that says, like, look, this is about you and your interpretation. I'm not going to tell you what this means. That's your job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now I'm curious, would you link this project of the Kant coloring book mm-hmm. to archival responsibility in the sense of the multitude of morphologies?
Yeah. I think the coloring book as a, right? It's like this. But I think it's, a couple of things are interesting about the coloring book is I have no idea how many copies were printed and circulated, but they're all out there. And so it might be really interesting to see all the different ways that the same book got used or got colored or got filled in or got the places where those things circulate and passed around. The other thing that I think the question of archives raises is, you know, most of the time my primary form of sort of cultural production is writing. I'm an academic. And so when we're writing about sex, like very often I feel it's like, you know, we're writing about other people's sex. We're writing about the sex that we saw in a movie or that we read about in a book or that, right? It's like this kind of separation from. And so I think the idea of like, what does it mean to, but the sex that we know the most about is of course the sex that we're having, right? So how do we think about or document or value our own sort of sexual archives? And how do we put those into forms that open up conversations for other people? And I do, I'm thinking of like Daniel, you know, your piece that was Daniel Sang, who wrote a very early piece about fucking online.
Yes.
And that was about your own sexual practice, right? And so that moment, in a way, created, kind of opened a space in the academy, right, mm-hmm. for people to sort of insert their own sexual practices into what we think of as academic scholarship, right? And that kind of changed it, right?
I'd actually really love to hear anybody else in
this
room.
Yes, I was just about to say.
It's like I'm seeing some eyebrows twitching. I'd
yeah.
like to hear this.
I was just about to say, let's open the discussion to the floor.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I'm not sure if this is necessarily about a kind of responsibility, but I was just wondering about this idea of transgenerational touch and as a way of, you said, like the transmission of knowledge through bodies. And I was wondering also about the question of conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, what are also sort of generational conflicts where we don't necessarily agree? And I think one thing that came up for me immediately is that I get so apprehensive when Title IX is mentioned in this context,
mm-hmm.
because there is this way, I feel like, of playing queerness and, I guess, sexual and gendered violence out against each other, and the
yes.
weird entanglements that happen, where I sometimes feel at this weird in-between position of, I'm a perverted queer, but I'm then read as a frigid feminist, who's like,
mm-hmm.
no. Like, so, I don't know, I was wondering how does that sort of, did that come up at all, maybe, in the project, in projects and teaching that you both do? And the kind of questions...
I've been warning Juana about this. Like, girl, you are setting yourself up for a really serious lawsuit.
Well, I've been writing about sex for a while, and I intend to keep doing that. The fact that I have tenure means that I get to do that, and I think that's sort of precisely what tenure's for. I think the intergenerational stuff is always like the third rail. Bum, 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 bum.
Mm-hmm.
You touch that and like everything explodes. And so I think it's curious that, so I think it's important for me to narrate sexual experiences that I had before I reached the age of legal consent,
mm-hmm.
where I was having illegal sex. And the people that I was having sex with could have been criminally charged. And that was sex that I consented to, that I enjoy, that I sought out, and that I authored.
Yeah.
In fact, that I authored. I think those conversations remain really difficult to have. So the idea that differences in power mean that that well, if consent can only exist in a condition of equal power relations, then very few of us are going to get laid tonight or tomorrow. right? That situation is quite different. And yet, I do think that there are these other tensions that we live with now, for example, that are different. When you're in a bar, it used to be that people would just go up, like, you know, go up and like pinch your nipple, or right, like the kinds of yes, right,
like part of how you show interest.
It's part of how you show interest, how right. But I think those codes are also changing. Mm-hmm. Those codes are also changing. So I think there's how do we? There's so much sort of sexual anxiety. So I also feel responsible for that sexual anxiety. I don't want to produce sexual anxiety in another person, right? Mm-hmm. So I don't hug my students anymore. Mm-hmm. I do the Wakanda salute. I do, because I don't feel I can hug them, mm-hmm. right? Because any kind of physical touch could potentially be, even though we're talking about college students who are already, could theoretically consent. So I think those situations are complicated, and I think mm-hmm. more and more what I worry about is how we're censoring our own sexual histories. Mm-hmm. If we can't talk about these moments, then that's a problem.
Absolutely.
You know, if we all pretend we started having sex when we were 18, then that's a problem.
And that we only had it with other 18-year-olds.
And that we only had it with other 18-year-olds.
Right, like, I don't know so much about, like, I don't know whether this is a particularly American thing, whether it's a particularly American thing from the 70s, but certainly in my generation, young dykes who didn't have a girlfriend who was much older and was willing to show them the ropes, or like, you kind of felt a little sorry for them, right? It's like, it's kind of nice to like figure it out with your age mates, but something completely different happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, sure, honey, let me show you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is good. Everybody knew this. But I want to say something about the question of touching students, too. That one of the ways that I personally deal with this, because I've actually had to deal with sexual harassment charges, and I have tenure. It's like, this is not a joke. And it's getting more and more and more intense as a way to undermine the security that tenure does provide. And when the people that you're talking about are untenured and untenurable, it is a way to get rid of them and to discipline all faculty through the fear that that causes. And it's real and it's intense. And sometimes those suits are brought in my school by trans students who do not understand that when you initiate a Title IX suit, you are ceding all agency in relation to the complaint that you are making, right? Because they don't have adult mentors to talk with them the way they need to about, well, what does it look like? Like, are there other ways? Are there other social avenues towards dealing with someone who persistently mispronouns you in a class?
Can you briefly just maybe for those who are not from North America say what Title IX is, just in two sentences?
Title IX is a federal bill that was initiated, I want to say, in the early 1970s to make it possible to bring lawsuits specifically against schools and universities that did not provide equal funding and access for women, especially in sports, is where it started. So it became a law that was used to open access specifically for women. And in recent years, I don't know exactly when or why, I wonder if Danny does. Do you know when Title IX began to turn towards a mechanism for discipline, by any chance? No, I don't know exactly either, but it's within the last 10 years or so that it's become this weird and very painful weapon to be used in many cases against especially queer women, and especially queer women of color in the academy. But
well, it's a mechanism, which means it is used against the chemistry professor who has sexually assaulted six of his, you know, or you know, who has sexually harassed six of his last
the thing
is
that
lab mates.
Fired.
Those people. Yeah. So
they just don't.
It's so those things. So it is both used mm-hmm. for that, but mm-hmm. it is certainly. Used against all kinds of queer and trans people, and and vulnerable populations are always more vulnerable.
I just wanted to add that in my university, you were required to take a sexual harassment workshop every year.
Yeah.
I quickly learned how to answer the questions correct without spending too much time on it. And the correct answer was never speak to your peer colleague first. And if that doesn't work, go above. The correct answer was always consult the highest possible authority and let them legislate it.
A complete undermining of the possibility of actual community or conflict resolution, which is really a problem. Not that I think you should have to do that if you've been sexually assaulted. I just want to be this like completely clear. But there are many, many, many circumstances, especially in academic classrooms or in creative classrooms, where what is at issue is fundamentally a mismatching of understanding of what a relationship of power looks like. And that should be, I believe, that should be addressed, possibly mediated, but between the people involved to the extent that that is possible to do. Because any other alternative ends up separating. What Title IX does is require by law that those people cannot talk to one another.
And it's all secret.
What can you resolve? So, the other thing I want to say about that is that in my classrooms, one of the ways that I began to develop this practice is I have students work with one another. They touch one another. I don't touch them. And because I often have survivors of sexual assault or various kinds of unwanted sexual touch in my class, because that is, in fact, the dominant experience for female-bodied people, we have to spend a lot of time working out what boundaries are cool for whom. And that, I think, is an important and legitimate part of educational experience. Like, one of the things I do is give people a chance to talk about what pleasures can we share in this room that are actually fully consensual for everyone involved. And that's not something that gets to happen in a college classroom, anything like enough. But it can happen in my because they have to confront one another with the possibility of touch. If they're all sitting in desks, it just wouldn't happen the same way.
Other questions? Yes, please.
I actually taught a class in Michigan in 1976. It was the first gay liberation class as a student or initiated thing. And Gail Rubin came in and taught. Mm-hmm. She was a schoolmate of mine, the same. And she had taught a women's liberation class earlier. And but at Irvine, I taught politics of sexuality, a continuing class. And I had Linda Williams come in to show slides. And she said she wanted to show slides. They thought it was less threatening to the students than movie clips. Because she could crop the two body parts. You couldn't tell it was male or female, and they're touching each other. So she could crop it so it looked very kind of androgynous.
Yeah,
so anyway, she did that. But even that class, we had to agree at some point to have consent agreements at the beginning to say, these are the things you have consent to if you take this class. You're free to walk out if we show a film you don't like, or you before the film is shown or whatever. So there are many ways they can get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but even so, people complained. Mm-hmm. And so I had to apologize to some students that were upset. And, but the Michigan case was interesting because I had taught politics of gay liberation, and it was the first class, in such class, and maybe in the academia, and they had to put the words in the transcript.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to out the students.
Because
what if their parents see the, what did you take today? What the class did you take this quarter and this semester? And so we negotiated. I asked them, there are 24 characters on the, or 18 characters or something.
Uh-huh.
On the IBM card that you
mm-hmm.
have to put in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we finally agreed to Paul of Lid. So it was very innocuous. But even so, the dean of the school of LSNA, he later became a president of a university in the South. He called me up and he said, we talked because I had to get a leaflet out. It was an uninitiated class, unusual class, so you had to circulate it. And he said, can you make the font smaller? So the word gay was smaller than all of the
Something was similar was still happening in the 1980s. The Barry Gross's class at the University of Pennsylvania, which was one of the first
big queer studies courses was called Communications, Cultures, and Sexual Minorities, precisely because the sexual minorities would not appear on a transcript. It would just be communications and culture, because you ran out of characters for that, right?
Did you also want to say something more? No, I have you in a second, yeah.
I forgot.
Okay, then we go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, I just wanted to ask about sort of how things change. Because I did an interview with Elizabeth Kennedy about her very first class in 1970 at the University of Buffalo, where, as was the norm in those days, the third class assignment was to squat over a mirror. And she yes. said to everyone in the classroom, you don't have to do this. And she taught that class, she told me, for 9 years, and no one ever opted out.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to sort of where you would map the shift and to what you would attribute it.
Well, I mean, I think specifically in gender women's studies, I think the idea that in the 1970s, people really were looking to their own bodies to kind of sharing these very corporeal forms of information. In part because it ended up sort of serving as a text. I don't have my students quote over mirror. and in part, I think right now, probably spend quite a bit of time in my classes speaking to the fact that gender women's studies, queer theory, that these are academic disciplines that are not just about your experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I frequently teach Joan Scott's The Evidence of Experience. That so the idea that your experience is already an interpretation of something that needs to be interpreted, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the very idea that you would squat over a mirror and look at your vagina or whatever you had there, and that this would be a kind of knowledge is already a kind of interpretation of what feminist knowledge might be, right? Yeah, I don't know quite what I want to say. I think the other thing that it made me think of was I took a class on pornography with Anne McClintock at Columbia University. It was kind of great, 10 o'clock in the morning, porn all the time. And what was interesting was we were watching porn, but no one could talk about, like, did it get you hard? Did it get you wet? Was it good porn, right? So we could analyze the shots and the screens and the kinds of bodies, but everyone was sort of afraid to sort of say, oh my goodness, right? Right? So there was that too, right? So there are these moments, I think these kind of fluctuations between when the sexual enters the classroom and when we kind of try to push it out. I remember there was the clip from Clips. There was Anne McClintock had asked me as the, you know, native informant of the queer dykes. She wanted pornography, most heterosexual pornography, the moment of female orgasm shoots up to the face. She wanted something else. So it was this fabulous G-spot orgasm, right? So this G-spot orgasm that is ejecting projectile fluid across the room. And the straight women in the class were like, rewind! And all of them were like completely silent. Like they had never seen anything like this before. It was this kind of visual evidence of this thing that women could, or some women could do, that all the women wanted to do. But it was kind of interesting how that moment just changed. Changed what was happening in the room, because something that people had very kind of different sort of connections to. They either wanted it or were terrified of the fact that they had never seen this before. Yes.
Yes, please.
Yeah, well, hi. We are talking about academia and particularly US academia here, right? And I was thinking about if we move a little bit to the streets, mm-hmm. and social movement, and what's going on there. And thinking about this wonderful Butler's book, What is an Alliance and the Politics of the Street, one of the things that we have seen in the last years is that, for example, Occupy movement, part of the queer assembly of the Indignados movement in Spain, and our assembly has been going on for many years already. One of the things that we've seen with Occupy movements has been precisely this, that people just like occupying the squares mm-hmm. and the streets, getting together, touching each other, like, hey, mm-hmm. how are you? What's mm-hmm. going on? Were you able to come to the assembly today? And how are your kids? Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. all these micro politics of, which are really like queer politics in the move, is what we are witnessing this last year. And for example, thinking about age, like Occupy movements have been in both in New York, mm-hmm. I don't know, London, Istanbul, Madrid, Athens, whatever, super heterogeneous. Mm-hmm. So that means that people from different ages, sexualities, genders, class backgrounds, educational levels, and so on. So these have been really an art, mm-hmm. really queer politics, and I think that tell us a lot about like this body politics, mm-hmm. right? Like this touching each other and caring about each other and so on. And for example, in the south of Europe, this has been actually our tool totally to confront the crisis, yeah. and precarity and so on. So I don't know, like some of us are activists, and mm-hmm. I think that we shouldn't mm-hmm. Lose that mm-hmm. when thinking about academia, what happens in academia with bodies and, mm-hmm. and sexualities. We don't talk about body sexualities and mm-hmm. so on. So talking about our own sexual practices, for me, personally, it's just like another world. I don't know. It's like I would love to do that, but how the hell do we do that? It's difficult. But at the same time, I think that these are really times of archival responsibility. Like, for example, talking to some students the other day, they were saying like, "Hey, what do you think about these transphobic attitudes in the feminist movement right now in Spain?" I was like, "We need to go back to the archives mm-hmm. because these transphobic attitudes were not before." Mm-hmm. So sorry, but no. This is pretty much like a U.S. Mm-hmm. story, pretty much. Mm-hmm. But this didn't happen in Spain. Mm-hmm. So our tool really there is going back to the archives and really looking at the documents, reading the stuff, and say, hey, this is something that didn't happen. Maybe it's happening now, just like in the small mm-hmm. sector of the movement that didn't happen. So I don't know. It's just like this big reflection about what you were saying. Yeah. So it's really time to recover all these sex positive memoirs.
But also like in the 1970s and 80s, even someone like Audre Lorde was very anti-butch and femme. I can't imagine that they would be super trans happy.
You know, that's interesting. Because I
just saying.
I talked to Audre Lorde's best friend, the woman who was with her when she died, yesterday, about exactly this, mm-hmm. because Eugene and I had an interesting conversation about what radical feminist meant in the 70s, which meant multi-alliance, it meant hooked up with communism, it meant all sorts of things that had nothing to do with hating trans people. So I asked mm-hmm. Audre Lorde's best friend, how she imagined that Audre's way of being in the world might have accommodated the presence of trans people inside feminism. She was like, she would have loved it. So, and she said, she doesn't get to tell us.
And people get to change.
There's a different kind of change. People do change as their circumstances change. A part of, I always read her narrative about rejecting butch femme as partly by the fact she didn't fit in it. Mm-hmm. Well, so she needed a larger social circle. People are like, yeah, what I do is, she might have been really happy in the queer moment.
You're looking at all your love right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one very last question or comment. Yes, please.
Yeah. Thank you. But I'm sorry I came late. There's a demonstration and the buses weren't running, so I'm very tired. And I've been mean mugging you the entire time. But I was interested in what you were talking about like the desire to create transgenerational touch, and especially when you're elaborating on this tattoo, right, that like whoever handles X as is handling Lou Sullivan. And like in a literal sense, that's not really true, right, because Lou doesn't get to be touched as a living being who gets to change his mind and respond. Mm-hmm. But her desire for Lou is part of that. And I kept noticing that this sort of anxiety about the youth not being sexual enough, that there's like a sex negativity problem and gender and women's studies departments or in the academy, Title IX is designed to protect the university, not the students or the faculty, right? Okay. So like that's the environment that we're all compelled to work for. But I was wondering if this anxiety isn't something you could elaborate in the terms of, like, how do we get people to facilitate sex with elders and between elders? Is there not some, just, like, some question here about wanting to be consumed by youth? Mm. That we could dig into a little bit? And maybe that's, like, too broad of a question for the last
maybe,
one.
Maybe short answers if possible, and we can continue the discussion in the lunch break.
Two simple questions. I fuck across generations. And, yes, it's a good cultural practice. But also, going back to this, when so much of dating right now is on apps, and the very first thing that apps do is screen by age. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing they do is screen by age. But when you're at that protest, you don't know the age of the person that you're rolling up on.
Yeah.
So there's something about, yeah, and you can lie.
Have an online
you can
age
lie.
And
that's
age.
Right. This is true. Yeah. So says something like that too. Also, too, about asexuality. I think there's sex negativity, but I also think it's also about creating different relationships to sex. Mm-hmm. So that before coming into sex was a mark of adulthood in certain ways. And I don't think that everyone comes into sex. I think there are more and more people that are simply choosing to not come into sex. And that's not necessarily sex negativity, it's just a lack of interest. And I think that's kind of okay too.
Also want to respond briefly?
I have never actually been particularly interested in young people.
Yeah.
They just kind of don't turn me on. And that was true when I was young too. No, they're Zach and Jordan were my ex-students. Zach and I advised Jordan's thesis. Zach I met the first day of their freshman year in college sitting in the front row of my introduction to the humanities course. That's part of why these relationships were possible is that they wanted me. I didn't want them, which made it really easy to kind of pull them along to, like, these are people my parents age. I was thinking of myself as a kind of transgenerational vector to get them to hook up with their grandparents, which actually was very powerful for them, right? Like, think, were any of you given the opportunity to think of people 50 or 60 or 70 years older than you as desiring subjects, like, rich? With decades and decades and decades of technique.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, that's a really cool thing to have someone hand you on a plate. And the other side of that is that the older people that I worked with were so into it. They loved having young people be like, hey, you're kind of cute. You know? Because that's not something that most people whose necks have fallen get to experience with, like, Jordan. You know, he's like juicy and young and full of collagen. And that's a really good experience for everybody, actually. There's just this enormous sense of, I think, of freedom to be a sexual subject as you age, that makes possible. And I do think that that's really useful for young people, especially if they're like, yeah, you know, I'm living in this world that's like full of perky tits on the internet, and I'm not really feeling it. I'm like, well, you know, maybe you'll get there when you're 50. Maybe 70. Don't worry. We have some time.
Thank you all.
Well, thank you very much.